And then,
there you go.
Senator Farioli was going to come on this or not.
On 47?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll see. We'll open up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Wednesday, February 10th. For what it's worth, and probably isn't worth a lot, I have always thought that February 10th, I always told everybody that February 10th was the day that I really started noticing the days were getting longer. I mean, all of a sudden it hits you, and so today is that day, February 10th. First of all, just so we have the timing right on these issues, is there anyone here in the audience currently for Senate Joint Resolution 42, Future Business Leaders of America? Is there anybody here on that one right there now? Okay, good. So we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 47. Mr. Stenberg.
Mr. Chairman, SJR 47 directs the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Department of Transportation to establish a wildlife safety corridor on U.S. Highway 26 between Picture Gorge and Prairie City in memory of Raymond Moles. You have the Dash 1 amendment, which adds specifics on the Highway 26 mule deer population situation there. And it directs the departments to work with the Grant County chapter of the Oregon Hunters Association to place two road signs designating the Raymond Moles Memorial Wildlife Safety Corridor.
Okay. I think I will begin by asking Al Elkins and Glenn Palmer. Glenn's more than 100 miles away, so let's start with those two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. First of all, I'd like to thank the sponsors of this resolution for bringing the memory of Mr. Moles forward and to signify the importance of the safety corridor. The people that are members of the Oregon Hunters Association remember Mr. Moles as an advocate of hunter education, youth hunts, founder of the Grant County chapter, and we are 12,000 members strong, and they believe that he signed up a great portion of those members, so we miss him dearly. We just want to let the committee know and ODFW and ODOT that we are excited about working on this project with them, and we will help them in any way we can. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Elkins. Mr. Palmer.
Hi. Good afternoon, Senator Metzger and the rest of the board. I appreciate the opportunity to come here from John Day and testify on something that means a lot to myself and some of the friends and family that I have here with me from John Day. My name is Glenn Palmer. I'm the sheriff in Grant County. I'm also a board member of the Grant County chapter of the Oregon Hunters Association. And Raymond Moles was a longtime family friend. Ray was a people person, and he shared the gospel with everyone that came into contact with him. Ray loved the outdoors and spent most of his time hunting, fishing, and viewing wildlife all over eastern Oregon. Ray and a couple other men founded the Grant County chapter of the Oregon Hunters Association in John Day. Ray took notice of something that was happening in our county on a very remote and short section of Highway 26 in the John Day Valley. During his travels, Ray noticed that an alarming amount of wildlife were being killed by automobiles. Carcasses littered the highway shoulders from Pitcher Gorge just west of Dayville to the east side of Prairie City. This area covers less than 50 miles, and literally hundreds of our deer and a few elk are being killed annually. Oftentimes, Ray sat in his recliner in his front room and listened to the local police scanner, hearing the officers from the local police department, from the Oregon State Police, and the Grant County Sheriff's Office being called over and over and over to deal with motor vehicle crashes where deer had been injured or were still on the roadway. Some of these collisions involved semi-trucks that would encounter several deer in a herd. The entire herd was wiped out in one fell swoop. Ray would call me several times a month trying to figure out what he could do to get people to slow down and watch out for the wildlife. Ray shared with me that he'd be driving during the evenings when the deer would be crossing the highway, trying to be a role model and example to others. Ray drove about 10 miles an hour under the speed limit. People whizzed past him as if he were standing still. This infuriated Ray. Invariably, a short distance up the road, he'd come across the vehicle involved in a collision, more deer and more carcasses on the roadway and on the shoulders of our highways. Ray took the time and expenses out of his own pocket and circulated petitions that were sent to local and state officials trying to get speed limits reduced, trying to get signage along the road that told people about the wildlife. Ray contacted local trucking firms in the mills, lecturing them on what was happening to our diminishing deer population. This became Ray's passion, and he took it personal. Ray was an advocate for the wildlife. This part of Grant County and Highway 26 contains a small population of resident deer. During the late summer, fall, and winter, this stretch of the road dissects critical winter habitat and range for deer and elk and some pronghorn antelope. This becomes home to several hundred and what used to be literally thousands of deer that have migrated out of the high country and into the John Day Valley. Since Ray passed away a little over 2.5 years ago, members of the local OHA chapter wanted a tribute and a dedication to a man who spent hundreds of hours working with state officials, local police, attending meetings he could, and with the media trying to get people to slow down and give our wildlife a break. Recently, ODFW designated the south side and a portion of this highway in the Murders Creek Wildlife Unit as a mule deer initiative in Grant County. This being done to increase and return our deer numbers and population to what we used to have. Our local OHA chapter supports and encourages the designation as a wildlife safety corridor in Ray Moles' memory. As sheriff of Grant County, I too support and encourage our state leaders to join us in making our highways safer and in an effort to educate the motorists using our roadway to slow down during peak migration times and give our wildlife a break. The Grant County chapter of the Oregon Hunters Association is dedicated and committing to using manpower and financial support and working with ODFW, ODOT, and our state legislature to get a section of our highway designated as a wildlife safety corridor to honor a man committed and dedicating to preserving our state's valuable resources and our wildlife. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Questions for either of our guests? Thank you for taking the time to come over. Senator Farioli, I saw you walk in. Please come join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ted Farioli, Senate District 30. First, let me thank the chair and the panel for hearing this bill. It's I think a really important statement, and let me just tell the story of what's behind the bill. I guess it was probably 5 or 6 years ago, Elizabeth Moles came to me and said, you know, we really need something done on this road because there's far too many accidents involving wildlife here. And I sort of filed that in the back of my mind, and you know, over the years, I'd think about, well, you know, I gotta do something. And about 2 years ago, maybe it wasn't quite that long ago, there was a temporary sign that was installed at just past Picture Gorge, and you know, reminded people there was a lot of deer on the road to slow down. And that kind of got me, sort of refocused on this issue. And there's something that you can observe on the road if you're observant and you travel it as much as I do, which is a lot. About every 80 yards or so, there's a splash stain on the road. And it doesn't occur to people that are driving over the road for the first time, but that is where a deer was hit. And literally, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these splash marks between Picture Gorge and John Day. And that's only half the route. You know, the other half of the route runs from John Day out to Prairie City and then out the canyon. Well, I got an opportunity to ask some people about the numbers, and it's just shocking the number of deer that are killed in that corridor. I personally, on any given afternoon in the wintertime, about 4 o'clock, can leave Picture Gorge headed east to go to John Day and count more than 1,000 deer in the corridor. Any afternoon you want to go out there. Now, don't tell the hunters, you know, because they'll all want to go out there. But like
they don't have their rifles now, remember?
Yeah, and they'll have to lock them up.
That's just another
goal. Yeah, we thought we did that earlier.
And then I got asking some folks from the ODFW, you know, why they put that sign up and what they thought about its safety corridor. And they were pretty supportive of the idea. And, you know, there's a couple of things going on there. Anytime there's an accident there that's got an injury involved, the costs to the community is astronomical. If there's a fatality, it's over $1 million by the time the lawsuits and the injury settlements are made and the investigations are done per occurrence, lost to the community. If it's an injury accident, it's not that expensive, but it's terribly expensive. And there's a little bit of physics involved. If you're driving that road after sundown at 60 miles an hour, you're overdriving your headlights by a half a second or more. And there's so many deer crossing that corridor because you've got alfalfa fields on one side and the river on the other, or vice versa. And the deer just seem suicidal, you know, and a lot of folks that are not familiar with driving in that condition will watch the deer go across the road and hit the one next in line. And when you start looking at the numbers and the cost and the lifelong crusade that Raymond Moles waged to have an educational opportunity to raise people's awareness that they were in an area where they were not just likely, but highly likely to see deer in the danger zone, that's within 250 feet of the front bumper, to slow down. At 50, you got a chance. At 55, you're a little too fast, and most folks, notwithstanding Glenn's efforts, are driving 60 at full dark. I mean, I get passed all the time on that road by people that I know are not familiar with the conditions that they encounter there. So the hope is that by designating this as a wildlife safety corridor, it's just another tool to help educate the traveling public that when they come into the valley, for their own sake and the safety of their families, slow down. And certainly to stop the slaughter. The catalyst for me was when I came around the corner here about a month and a half ago on the way to Salem, and there was a truck stopped in the road, and he'd hit two deer and wrecked the front end of his car. And this is in full daylight. And I just thought to myself, well, you know, his day is ruined, the front end of his car is wrecked, and it could have cost him his life. And maybe just that little bit of awareness can slow down the carnage. The business community and the citizens of John Day over the years have written letters and petitions. There's literally thousands of signatures here supporting some kind of a safety corridor. And what I've offered to you for your consideration is a Senate joint resolution. We're not making this a big deal. It's an important deal. And it's a tribute to Ray Moles, and it's essentially a prayer to people to think twice and slow down, and not just to protect the wildlife, but their own families. So I hope you'll take action today on the bill if you have an opportunity, and that we can move it forward.
Well, thank you, Senator. And as you know, I spent a lot of time in your area in Grant County about 2 years ago in this time of year, and was amazed. It seemed like every 6 or 7 miles, you'd look down the little canyon by a creek, and there'd be, like you say, you start counting them. There's a herd of 26, and there's a herd of 51, and it's just, they all came down and for that thing, and it was just amazing, and I appreciate you bringing this forward very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have the... Welcome, Senator Farioli.
Yeah.
We have the Jason Bow corridor, right. And it's very appropriate. People appreciate it. We like it. It's on Highway 38. The sign reads, you are now entering. And I'm just looking at this, the wording on this, and I'm wondering, so that people could read it without it being too wordy, if that would be what would be on the sign, that memorial might be taken out that would read Raymond Moles Wildlife Safety Corridor, because I believe that the sign will read, you are now entering. Now, maybe not. Maybe if it doesn't, you don't have too many words. I really appreciate your bringing this forward. And I do think that it does, I think it will do some of what you want to accomplish. Not all, but some, and that will help. But I do worry a little bit about it being so long on the sign that as people go through, they don't get it.
Mr. Chairman, I would regard that as a friendly amendment. The point is, to honor Raymond Moles and to ask people to think and slow down.
And I appreciate your comment. And the one thing about our joint resolution, it is the sentiment of the legislature. It's not the effect of law. So they could wordsmith that sign to the pleasure of best honoring Mr. Moles. And that's since we are going to move it out today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is a place and time when we should be quiet.
Amy Joyce and Kurt Melcher, please.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, handed in some written comments and just have some brief words about this joint resolution. This stretch has seen a lot of wildlife deaths over the years, particularly mule deer and Rocky Mountain elk, and protecting these animals and reducing these deaths was a cause championed by Mr. Ray Moles. The joint resolution would establish this memorial, a safety corridor, to encourage motorists to be aware of the existence of these animals in this area. And it would continue the efforts of the department in this area to reduce deaths, including recently with the temporary sign that was placed during hunting season where the traffic count is higher to help reduce these deaths. So that stands ready to continue our efforts, including with the placement of signs in this area. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Mr. Melcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I too will be brief. We provided some written comments as well. I wanted to say firstly that we had a long history working with Mr. Raymond Moles, our local staff. He was a great and strong advocate for Oregon's hunting heritage, but also for good wildlife stewardship, and I think you've been hearing about that here today. This stretch of Highway 26 is clearly one of the highest deer mortality sections in the state. I believe the Department of Transportation collects annually about 600 deer carcasses from that stretch of road. We conservatively estimate that the annual strikes probably approach 2,000, 1,200 to 1,800, conservative estimate. Many animals that are struck don't immediately die. So just to put that in a little bit of perspective, the annual hunter harvest of mule deer bucks in the adjacent units totals about 2,000 annually. So we're putting these mortalities are close to or equivalent with the harvest by licensed hunters. I believe it's an important wildlife conservation issue, but also an important safety issue, as you've heard here. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Starr.
Is this safety corridor, does it do anything as it relates to a motorist that's speeding? In other safety corridors, we have double fines. Is that applied in this safety corridor as well?
Chair Metzger and Vice Chair Starr, no, that provision does not apply.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Joint Resolution 47 with the -1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, the -1 amendment says Chair 47.
Senator Starr has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Joint Resolution 47. Discussion? Any objection? Order.
Mr. Chairman, the resolution as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Joint Resolution 47 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection. So ordered. Senator Farrelly, would you be kind enough to carry the bill on the floor? Okay. Now we'll open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 42. Mr. Stambridge.
This is my Mr. Chairman, Senate Joint Resolution 42 establishes May 1st, 2010 as Future Business Leaders of America Day in Oregon.
Okay. This is brought to us by Senator Schrader and has guests Dalton Hellman and Tanya Bousted.
Okay.
And if you would like to begin the discussion from up here. Senator Schrader, please do.
Let me just start by saying I welcome these two young people here today. Actually, Dalton contacted me and came up with the idea, and I thought it was such a good idea to honor the FBLA because these young folks are the future of, I hope, our businesses here in Oregon. And I want to welcome both of you and give you an opportunity with my colleagues here and Chair Metzger to testify on behalf of this joint resolution today.
Thank you, Senator, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Metzger, and members of the committee for giving me this opportunity to be here today. My name is Dalton Hellman. I'm the president of Canby High School's FBLA, and I'm here basically to testify and tell you a little bit about what we're doing with this. This is a program known as the GPP, or the Government Promotion Project, through FBLA in the state of Oregon. Essentially what this is we're trying to build a gap between government, not only at the local, but at the state and national level as well, with individuals in high schools as well as in college. There's the PBL, which is the FBLA and the college level, and then there's also the professional level for those of you who are in businesses. Essentially, what we have to do is we were asked, one of the requirements was to go to your local city and talk with your mayor to get a proclamation for an FBLA day in your city. And I went to my mayor, Melody Thompson, and talked to her, and we got a proclamation set for an FBLA day in the city of Canby. But for me, the GPP was more than that, and that I wasn't going to stop at just the local level. So I contacted Senator Schrader because I've spoken with both Senator Kurt and, or I guess now Representative Kurt Schrader and Senator Mark.
We confuse
Schrader.
Them too all.
Yeah. I'm the better looking.
Before, and so I had met both of them before, and I contacted Senator Schrader and asked if she would help me with this project and getting this resolution put forth, because I believe it's a great opportunity. I mean, I'm sitting here before you today, which is, in and of itself, is quite unbelievable. I know Senator George graduated Oregon State with a bachelor's degree in international finance, so you know about the business world. And so I think FBLA is an organization. We have over 250,000 members in the United States and across the nation. And so it's a great organization, and I feel that this project has given us the opportunity to, if we put it on a state level, and recognize it on May 1st, as the resolution has put forth, that we will be able to celebrate and raise more awareness of FBLA through the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hello. As Dalton's advisor, the Canby High School FBLA advisor.
Please your name for the record.
Oh,
for those who can hear but can't see.
Sorry. I am very proud that Dalton would come for this experience, and this project, the Government Promotion Project, has really excited some of my students that it was a little unexpected for me. This is out of most high schoolers' comfort zone to come down here and speak in front of people. So I thank you for letting us come today, and I'm just proud and excited to watch Dalton and hope that this day will work so that he can come back to our chapter and hopefully be recognized at our state conference for his accomplishments working on this project.
Excellent. Okay. Questions? Senator Schrader.
I just want to thank you, Dalton, for putting this forward, because one of the things that we want young people to understand, and you as a young adult who's interested in moving into the business world, as well as educators who are helping us with our young folks, is that this is a very open and accessible process, and that it is up to you if you want to move policies forward, resolutions forward, to give us a call. Contact your local state representative or your local state senator, and we are more than willing, and it's the Oregon way, to open our doors, listen, and have you move forward with a great policy for what a wonderful program this is. And also, I wanted to let you know, I have a fondness for Canby High School. All of, five of my kids went through Canby High School and are very successful right now. It's a wonderful school. It's a great school district, and I just want to compliment your teacher for encouraging you to come down here and do this. It's really what we expect. If I can pride a place with Canby, it truly is what we expect to see happen in our local community. And quick question for you. So what are you, a junior, senior?
I'm a senior this year at Canby High.
Okay, so where are you looking at colleges?
Pacific University, and then for my law degree, probably Willamette.
University. So what are you planning to do at Pacific?
Political science and history.
Oh, colleagues, should we talk about the political science part of it? I'm only kidding. It's a good field to go in. And my older daughter did political science and international studies, and my younger daughter's in law school right now too. So good to have you here today. And I'm also hopeful, and I'm sorry for going on so long, colleagues, that when we have this resolution up, we would certainly like to invite the entire FBLA class from Canby to come down and be present so we can introduce you on the floor, and then actually anyone else that you can help arrange to come here from across the state. We have colleagues, obviously, who would be more than welcome to welcome you, have you be here in the Capitol, and show you courtesies on the floor of the Senate. So
great. Thank you, Senator. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say that all of our youth organizations, DECA, VICA, FBLA, FFA, all of those have been hugely instrumental in creating a lot of great business leaders. And I just want to talk about FBLA for a moment. One of my closest friends was the state president of FBLA when I was in high school. And I think she would tell you that this particular club was instrumental in her picking her career. She's now a business consultant who lives in Washington, D.C. and travels all over the world. Has spent a year in Uzbekistan, a year in Georgia, the country, all of those being a business consultant for developing countries. And a lot of it stemmed directly from her experience as a state president of FBLA. So a lot of times our education clubs don't get as much credit for creating a lot of our business leaders in the state, but FBLA has been key in a number of people I've known personally. It's a great organization. I'm glad, Dalton, that you brought this forward, because I think it's really important that we recognize the state does fund this through the Department of Education,
right.
And it's usually one of the very first budgets that we trim is support for the Student Leadership Center. But we need to keep in mind that the Student Leadership Center's the bang for the buck for that particular program is outstanding, and Dalton, I think you represent the FBLA well. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion. One question, since about future business, does Canby still have their aquaculture facility still growing tilapia out there? Do you know?
I don't know. As far as I know, I haven't heard of it.
Okay.
That was a number of years ago, and the Bioscience Center actually helped write the grant for that center with Max Sherman, who's now who's a teacher there. And it was my kids were there when it was available, and it was pretty innovative, and it funneled kids to Oregon State University in biotechnology. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's a good program.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Joint Resolution 42.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I'll invest GR 42 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Joint Resolution 42 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Schrader, would you be kind enough to carry that for us?
Thank you. I will.
Okay. All right. Close work session on Senate Joint Resolution 42. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1050. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members, we have a conceptual amendment that we have distributed. I think there are copies available here, and we emailed the conceptual amendment to many people who have been interested in this bill. It is conceptual because it does not fit the current bill, but has elements that were to be discussed today. So,
okay. Thank you. What, as we go through the testimony on this, this will be important to hear your comments on it. There's another bill on the House side, 3604, which will probably be the vehicle that we're going to end up using. Some of the issues that have been brought forth and trying to reach a consensus on this bill don't fit our specific relating clause. They will fit the other one. So because our committee is hearing this and we'll hear it again as we are still wanting to get this thing resolved, this will be an opportunity to hear that, and I know that the people that have been working on this bill will continue to do that, and hopefully we'll get it back very soon. So I think I'll ask Ryan Tribbett and Bob Shiprack to come forward to update us on where we are and going off our current amendment status, and then we'll call up other folks to comment.
Thank you. For the record, Ryan Tribbett with Ironworkers Local 29 and the Building Trades Council. Thank you for the opportunity to come back for round three on amendments on this important policy. We've made a significant amount of progress through working with a number of interested parties, most notably AGC, was in meetings with Legislative Council and helping us draft these language changes. We have accepted every amendment that's been given to us or every idea that's been given to us that moves the process forward and is constructive to helping, as Senator Verger says, get to yes. I'll just go quickly through some of the most notable changes. It relates now to public improvement. It says public improvement projects. That was the piece that was causing a lot of heartburn for people in having a different definition of something that was had added the tax credits and the other pieces. This was a piece that was supposed to be in the dash twos. It is, I believe, fixed now to the definition that everyone knows and is comfortable with using in public contracting. You will notice that we have now identified, instead of just saying manufactured materials and drawing a very broad brush, we've picked some of the most used materials that would get at the biggest bulk of it, so it's a finite list of materials. In terms of the issue that was brought up last time about the VW bug, that was if that was recycled in America, would that be a German steel product or would that be an American steel product? That that issue was straightened out through the directing the AG's office and ODOT and DAS to develop model rules about what percentage of the product is produced here, if certain components of raw materials that go into a manufactured good are from a different country. That would be to provide clarity, and then I believe that is those are the main pieces. I think we still have an issue with the emergency clause, or not the emergency clause, but the declaration of emergency. It still looks like they've included this to be something where it has to be raised to the level all the way up to the governor's office to declare a state of emergency. On the record, that is not our intent. If somebody runs over a fire hydrant or something, it is not our intention to have the city have to run it up the flagpole to the county and of the county request from the governor to declare a state of emergency. We mean a emergency health and safety issues that need to be addressed right away, not a declaration of a state of emergency. And with that, I think that outlines the biggest changes that we've made. And I'll just say for the record also that I think we've come a long way to getting people to yes. I'm not sure that everyone will get there at the end of the day, but it is our commitment that there will be clarity, there will be clear of what's expected under a Buy American policy.
Thank you, Mr. Let's go to Mr. Shiprack and we'll see if there's questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We'll just echo what Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building Trades Council. One thing that I didn't hear, and we didn't obviously rehearse our testimony, but one of the major things that we discovered, and I want to thank the AGC for letting us borrow their attorney that works with their employers on these issues, because there is a federal Buy America law, which contractors in Oregon are now under currently. And Mr. Vermilia, I think that was his name, was extraordinarily helpful. There is, in fact, in his words, approximately a 30-page document that the feds have that explains how it's supposed to work, and it specifically addressed something that Senator George brought up that has kind of, in the back of my mind, troubled me, and that's how does this interface with our trade treaties. And in fact, the feds are very clear that it does not supersede NAFTA and the various other trade agreements that we have with other countries, which I think is very important. I mean, the state of Oregon doesn't do international trade treaties, so we would put those sideboards up there. So I'm frankly very encouraged. I think we might have for an ultimate vote on this a very favorable bill that I think that we can all be really proud of, that it's going to be much clearer to understand and work. We also had examples of how this is being done under the federal law, Buy America law, and in fact most of the work, frankly, is done by the contractors who, as they go out and get their bids, they obviously have to get material bids, that you get a letter from the manufacturer that states, yeah, this is where this is made at. And it's given to the local public contracting agency. They go, okay, works. So we're just trying to mirror something that's already being done, and but maybe help the state of Oregon put some people to work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shipwreck. Questions for either Mr. Shipwreck, Mr. Trillard? Well, thank you for your continued work on this, and I do recognize significant progress on some of the key issues, so we'll be curious to see, as some people come up, addressing this conceptual amendment, how we are with that as we continue to work on this in the House version. So, thank you,
John. Thank you very much.
Diane Lancaster, Tom O'Connor, and Ann Hannes, please.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, I am Diane Lancaster, the State Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services. First, I want to thank the committee, and particularly Senator Verger, for pulling together work groups and encouraging us to stay at this work. I have not done a formal analysis yet of the conceptual and will be glad to do that, but I am delighted to see that many of the issues that were submitted in my written document to members of the committee yesterday appear to have been taken into consideration, and this is looking very, very good. So I am anxious to get back to my office, look at it carefully, and hopefully be able to return with a positive answer around our position on
this. Well, I appreciate that, Ms. Lancaster, and I appreciate the great work that Senator Berger is doing this and keeping people informed, and I'm sure what she would say is if we don't have lots of time, but we're determined to try to get to yes on this. So if you find a particular issue to be as specific as possible in converting and conveying that to Senator Verger, that would be helpful then.
It will be my pleasure, sir.
Thank you. Ms. Hannes, let's go with Ms. Hannes next.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I, too, want to commend Senator Verger. She's been very diligent in bringing together all the stakeholders and listening to everybody's concerns, and that's been clear as the different amendments have evolved. I have written testimony that I'm submitting to you. Our concerns have focused mainly on whether or not there'd be significant cost increases or delays of important projects. This is a really complex issue in law, as well as in contracting, and it's one where we all want to make sure, I think together we all agree, that we want to get projects done and get people back to work. But it's really complicated by the global economy, where you may have a project and you may have a major component, for example, that may have a variety of different components from not only locally but around the world. So some, I think, if we can have some clarification on, you know, what is truly American-made? You know, if it's 80% or 90%, is that American-made? What kind of products are we looking at? And then we also suggested adding some federal language that talks about inclusion of small amounts of foreign-made products so as not to impede construction, because sometimes, say, if you have a product that's recycled, there may be steel from all over the world in that recycled product, even though it may be made here in the United States. We also think it would be good to talk through how this would affect various different agencies or the kind of projects that locals would be involved with. And I'm sorry, but with a short time frame, it's been hard to do a really thorough analysis. For example, there was a recent project that was done in Tiger, the Durham Advanced Wastewater Treatment Plant. It was a $30 million project, and there were tens of thousands of parts that were involved in that particular project, and some of those components were sourced both locally and globally. So I think we all want to make sure that we have projects that we can be able to get done in a timely way, as well as not have a significant increase in costs. What we would suggest is that I think we've made a lot of progress. If there's a little more time where we can reconvene the work group, maybe work through some more of these issues and see if we can get a bill that everyone can agree upon. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hannes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Tom O'Connor with the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We are, as I've said before, small, medium-sized publicly owned utilities. We are subject to the public contracting requirements. We also pay prevailing wage on all of our projects. We are subject to prevailing wage requirements. I think this draft addresses a lot of a number of things that we were concerned about, particularly the application to loans and tax credits for energy efficiency. There are three just specific, I want to try to, in response to the request, try to be real specific about a couple of things that we still are concerned about. Number one, for us, the 25%, what in effect is a 25% premium or preference here, seems to us to be awfully high. That's a big swing for a project for a mid-sized utility like Canby or Forest Grove or any of our other folks. That's a risk that we'd have to build in. If in the existing public contracting statutes, there's a 5% premium for recycled products that this legislature has adopted. There's a voluntary up to 10% premium for Oregon agricultural products. It just seems to us that 25% is an awfully big risk for us. Something more along the lines of those kinds of premiums that are in statute make a little more sense to us. And it was already addressed, I think, by the proponents. The emergency clause as drafted in here would mean that the governor would have to declare a statewide emergency. Obviously, if we get a substation that goes out or a dam that goes out, we've got to move fast. It needs to be something other than a state-declared emergency. Three, we agree that it is really useful to have the AG do model rules like they've done with other public contracting statutes. We are concerned, however, about the scope of that. On page 2, lines 3 and 4, the language appears to give unlimited authority to the AG without any further legislative action, the ability to go in and add components and materials and so on to the list that's in the bill. I think we were a little uncomfortable with that kind of broad ability to go in and change what's here. We'd like to see that pinned down a little bit. So those are the three things that I think that we're particularly concerned about at this stage.
Well, thank you, and I made a note of them, and I do appreciate the specificity. I know the proponents will, too, because that will help narrow our issues. Questions for either of these three folks? Okay, thank you. Ken Armstrong, John Ledger, and Drew Hagedorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Public Ports Association, Oregon's 23 public port districts. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and testify on this. I also appreciate the efforts of the proponents of the bill to continue to talk and have conversations in what I perceive as being very good faith, trying to resolve the issues that have been raised both through the work group and also in one-on-one conversations. Senator Verger, bringing this bill, it's very clear where your heart is on that, and that's with jobs, jobs is with the American worker. We know it's with your ports, too. And so we appreciate that effort. We have been working very hard trying to get to a place of fully understanding what the implications are of the amendments. You'll see that I signed up neither in support nor in opposition. We're definitely not in opposition to the bill. I think everybody understands and agrees with the concept of where we're trying to get. We have had, as recently as up to about half an hour ago, feedback coming back from my ports trying to fully understand the conceptual amendments, what are effectively the dash threes to House Bill 3604. Those comments are summarized in a one-page letter that I've distributed for you. A number of those comments you've already heard here today. I'm not going to revisit that. We do stand ready to continue to have conversations and to work on this, try and get to yes. We are concerned about being able to actually achieve it here in this February session. If we can, that's wonderful. If not, we pledge to stay at the table and talk. We'll do everything that we can to get where we need to be on this, but we still do have some concerns, and my folks are not fully comfortable understanding all the implications, but we're trying to get there. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Drew Hagedorn for the Associated General Contractors. I want to echo Ken's sentiment. Mr. Chair, we appreciate your willingness to work with us, as well as Senator Berger and her work organizing work group meetings and so forth. And also the bill's proponents, Mr. Shiprack and Mr. Tribbett, have been excellent in working with us on our principal concerns to the bill, which was the public subsidy definition that was originally intended to be inserted into the public contracting code. We were concerned with that language because we felt it contradicted with other key provisions of the contracting code. So we're pleased to see in the conceptual amendment that that language has been removed, and we thank the proponents for working with us on that. To the conceptual amendment, as it's currently drafted, we do have some suggestions for clarifications and maybe in one instance of a policy suggestion. The first is that the amendment uses the term contract for public improvement. And we would recommend for clarification purposes changing that to public improvement contract. That's a term that's defined in ORS 279A010. It's used throughout the public contracting code, so we'd recommend that little tweak. I don't believe it has any substantive policy changes there. Also, the amendment uses the terms materials and components. Instead, we recommend using the term goods. That's defined at ORS 279A010I. Goods includes supplies, equipment, materials, personal property, etc. We feel that would encompass the notion of materials and components. This was already mentioned, but I'll briefly lend our support to it, that Section 12AB, which gives discretion to the AGC, the Attorney General, to determine additional materials or components that should be subject to the Buy America requirements. We too believe that's too broad and recommend deleting that subsection. And then finally, a clarification issue, and this is probably a policy matter for your consideration. If you look at Section 13BA, it allows an exemption for the entire public improvement contract cost if it is increased by more than 25%. We recommend making that more precise so that the exemption kicks in if the cost of goods is increased by more than 25%. Finally, I would note that in our research on this issue, we noted that at ORS 279A.120(2), there's an existing preference in the Oregon Public Contracting Code for goods and services that are manufactured or produced in Oregon. I wanted to call that to the committee's attention. These things, I think, take care of our principal concerns. I know that others have already expressed concerns related to the fiscal impact of public owners. And I think Mr. Shiprack astutely made the observation on the international trade issue. We believe that that is a concern. It's somewhat of a current event. You may have heard last Friday the United States government in Canada finally came to over a year-long debate, as I understand it, concerning the Buy American federal program and its implications on the NAFTA agreement. In fact, our legal counsel, Jeremy Vermilia, who Bob referenced, was contacted by the Canadian consul for a briefing on this bill, and I believe they're meeting tomorrow, so I'll be happy to let you know what transpires with that and report back to the committee. But want to conclude by again thanking you, Senator Verger, and the bill's proponents for working so diligently with all the stakeholders to kind of craft a solution that works for everyone. With that, I'll close. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hagedorn. Mr. Ledger.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries, and I'll be fairly brief. You've heard a lot of concerns that we have, which is revolving around uncertainty and how things would work. We are talking billions of dollars here. an extended period of time. We don't know, or I don't know, or maybe we haven't heard yet, what this would do as far as administration time, if it would put projects longer scope of time to be approved or processed. We don't know how much it would drive up the projects, if it would drive them up 10% or 25%. When we're talking billions of dollars, that is an enormous amount of money. We don't know what it would do. It really is scope of the bill itself. When you're looking at structures or fittings made of iron, steel, or wood, that doesn't leave a whole lot out. So we have just a lot of questions over this. This is a huge bill, billions of dollars that we're trying to do in 2 weeks or so, although I think everyone is making a good faith effort to get there, but it is huge. I'd like to mention that there is a bill, I assume, coming to you from the House. It did come out of a House committee today that will do essentially this, look at how to do local purchasing and providing incentives for local purchase, preferences for local purchase, and involves putting together a group of contractors, environmental experts, trades, construction people, and actually going through this and coming back with something that actually had been well thought out and vetted. I would just urge you to think very careful about this, because this is an enormous piece of legislation. The last thing I will leave you with very quickly, because this is a committee here that is looking at jobs, and that kind of falls under your purview. And that's why this is of such interest to you, which is a good thing. And what I would urge the committee, and I'll just take 15 seconds here, is there are many bills that come through this legislature that impact jobs that you should see that you don't. And I'll give you an example. Last session's cap and trade bill had huge job implications. It was coming out of the Environment Committee. It wasn't scheduled to come to you, but it should have, because it has huge job implications. The agencies are, you want to save jobs. There are rules now coming out, looking at rules, that would set water quality standards below naturally occurring. It's going to have an enormous impact on jobs and manufacturing. And yet, nothing like that ever comes before this committee, because it's done under the purview of the agencies. And I would just urge this committee to become much more active on lots of things that can keep companies from moving overseas, so we don't have to look at doing something like this in the first place. We'd rather keep the jobs here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ledger. Questions? Senator Virgil.
Mr. Ledger, thank you for those comments. I couldn't agree more. I believe that there are some, there's legislation that goes through that even if another committee hears it, I think that it would be a really nice thing to give us a shot at it, if that makes sense. Mr. Hagedorn, I have a couple of questions for you. One is, you said delete the section about the Attorney General. Were you not suggesting that something be replaced there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Verger, I think it's prudent, first off, to give the Attorney General some rulemaking authority to promulgate model rules for agencies to consider. I was talking about at 1-2-A-B, that section that talks about, I think it's exceptions to the general rule.
Small B, a contracting agency,
exactly.
Other than?
So where it says additional materials or components, we just felt that was sort of broad, that at least as an initial step, we ought to be focused on those elements that were described there.
Okay.
Lines 3 and 4
on page 2.
Great. Further questions?
And I heard him say that the NAFTA agreement takes precedent, and would you explain to me what you might be getting back to us about tomorrow?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, the Canadian consul, the representative for the Canadian consul in Oregon, contacted Jeremy Vermilia, the legal counsel that we've been working with on this issue, and apparently the Canadian consul had some sort of concerns related to this piece of legislation. I don't know what those are in particular.
Okay.
So that's what I wanted to report back to you on.
Right.
As I mentioned, last Friday there was an agreement between the United States and Canada related to this, and I mentioned that more just to illustrate the complexity of the issue.
Sure.
To
no.
On what
what Bob said.
So, I appreciate it. I hope you will get back to us. Thank you for
that
clarification.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussions? Thank you. The last panel, folks, not necessarily a panel, but the three people calling up, Mark Landauer, Scott Winkles, and Rich Angstrom.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities, while we are not opposed to this bill or the companion, or I wouldn't say companion bill, but the similar bill that's going through the House of Representatives this time, we appreciate the concept, we appreciate the objective. We do, however, have some concerns in regards to how those objectives is going to be achieved. First off, one of those chief concerns is this has the potential to drive up costs for public improvement contracts. We've been taking a look at a water project, a joint water project between the city of Tigard and the city of Lake Oswego. We're looking at a $60 million materials purchase contract. Most of that is going to be in the form of piping, metal piping. The question that the public engineer who's responsible for leading that project had for me was, if they purchase pipe that's made of metal, but the metal isn't made in the U.S., but the pipe is that, are we in compliance? Would they be in compliance? And I don't know that we have an answer for them at this time, mm-hmm. and that is a concern. Additionally, and I won't touch on issues others have covered, we have some concerns with the opt-out provisions in the bill, particularly the finding that's not in the public interest and the finding that there isn't sufficient supply or quantity of the materials available. There's no exemption of those. If a public body makes that such a finding, there's no exemption from the judicial review provisions of 279 contained within the legislation. So an unsuccessful bidder could challenge that finding in court, or if they draw out a process for over a year, exposing that public agency to significant expense and administrative trouble, and essentially delay what is most likely a critical infrastructure project. The league is committed to working to find a way to achieve the objectives of this legislation in a manner that is going to allow critical infrastructure projects to go forward. And I would point out respectfully that the last time the legislature chose to incentivize a certain the purchase of products, they chose an opt-in provision. If you wanted to look at ORS 279A128, there is a provision in statute in regards to agricultural preferences. We're not a member of those cities, don't generally buy ag products, but what the legislature allowed a public agency to do was purchase these products and give those competitors, those Oregon companies, a 10% competitive advantage in their RFPs. And the agencies are allowed to opt in. We believe a similar approach would be appropriate and meaningful with this legislation.
Next.
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. Mark Landauer here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We have approximately 880 members across the state of Oregon. I'd first like to compliment Senator Verger and the proponents of this measure. We have come a long way since the original draft, and there's a great deal more clarity in the conceptual amendment that is before you today. I'd like to thank all folks who have been involved thus far and can sort of narrow down the concerns that we have with the bill. I would like to echo several of the comments that were provided to you by Mr. O'Connor and Mr. Hagedorn. I shared similar concerns and suggestions that they have made. I would like to just mention two other specific concerns that haven't been mentioned thus far. The first is the bill currently does not spell out the consequences of noncompliance. For example, if it is discovered in the process of public improvement that a product, in fact, has been foreign sourced, what happens in that instance? Do we have to stop the entire project? What are the processes by which we can begin to get that product project completed. As you know, in construction, time is money, and this is the public's money. We want to use it efficiently and effectively, and I think that it would be helpful for public entities to know what are the remedies when something goes wrong. The second question related to that is whether or not the local government would be liable in the instance when it is discovered during or after the fact that foreign materials have been used to construct a project. What are the processes by which you address that problem? The final point that I'd like to make is there is an exception that is contained in the draft measure, conceptual measure, that can be found on line 28 and 29 of the second page, and it references a declaration of emergency under ORS 401.165. I'd like to note for the committee that that is a governor-declared emergency that only counties can request. Cities can ask for that declaration as well, but only through a county. That leaves several other types of public bodies left wondering what they would do in the event of an emergency, and I realize that there is also an exception above that when it is inconsistent with the public interest, but I think that some further clarity would be helpful, and there are currently in the public contracting statutes the ability for the public contracting agency to declare an emergency, and would recommend that perhaps mirroring that language would be helpful and certainly solve some concerns that the people I represent have. And thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Schleiner. Any questions? Okay, thank you all. Where we're going?
Did Engstrom testify?
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, I just assumed that you were going to say the same thing. You were sitting in the middle, you know. I talked about rocks and gravel.
Rocks and gravel.
Okay, I apologize, Mr. Engstrom. Please.
It's okay. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, thank you. My name's Rich Engstrom, and I'm the president of the Construction Materials Industries for Oregon. I represent the aggregate guys, the concrete guys, the cement guys, and on occasion the asphalt guys on certain topics. When I originally was thinking about what I was going to say here, I was going to keep it short and just say that concrete really doesn't belong on this list because of its perishable nature and its shelf life. Where concrete as a product usually is market area is limited to 30 miles, and you don't really ship concrete overseas and expect it not to set up before you get it to the job site. But the issue is, and by example, and I think concrete's a good one to use by example of what happens with some of the components in this list, is comprised of other materials, cement being one of them, and cement is fairly international in its production, with Oregon having one company in Durkee that produces cement. And aggregate generally is local, but because of our land use related issues, we now are shipping even our aggregates from British Columbia, Vancouver Island, to provide resource material. So just from a construction materials component, you know, some products are global in nature in their market, some are national in their market, and some are local. Concrete tends to bring it all in as an example. And the issue, I think, for you folks to consider as a real example is we have four cement companies in Oregon. We have Ashgrove. We have Glacier Northwest. Bob Short's OCAPA's current chairman. We have Lehigh and Lafarge, and they both produce their cement material in Canada under actually quite stringent environmental standards there. Ashgrove now has an offloading facility where they're also bringing material in from China or Hawaii, or I'm not exactly sure, but it's international. And then the local site, which is the Durkee facility. And the effect, this would affects not only, would not only create a monopoly, I guess is the best way to say it, but it would also cause great expense to ODOT and other folks doing public works projects. Currently, if you just take the aggregate side, and I'm going to say that cement, concrete is probably proportional, 60% of the use of that material is for public works. And if you relate that to the cement use, 60% of the cement or the cost of cement is also that we use in the state is for public works projects also. And that's a little probably a little bit variable, but it gets in the ballpark of for explanation purposes. If you can confine that to one company because all the rest of them are international, you'd essentially create a monopoly. You'd affect the jobs of all of those companies that are contingent and U.S.-based jobs and Oregon-based jobs that rely on those international sources of cement. And you'd create quite a problem not only for the public works folks. I think it would result in loss of jobs, and I think it would be counter to what you're actually trying to accomplish here. So I can't speak for the others that are on this list, but I can say that I don't think concrete should be on this list. So with that, Chair Metzger, that concludes my testimony.
Okay. Well, and thank you, Mr. Angstrom. I guess just one observation I would have is I understand you're thinking about the sole source, but if you can look at the broader picture, and I think why this bill is before us and why Senator Berger has worked so hard on it, is to ask the question why you have one sole source. I mean, because how difficult is it to site a cement plant, and is that the right way to go, or whatever it is. And I did speak a while back to the folks, the good folks here that's been at the Capitol and are at the Capitol today about jobs and representing the various trades, and I thought it was illustrative. I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal today and about China, and it was a report, among other things, cement and steel were mentioned specifically, that the amount of pollutants into the environment to create those products was three times greater than what had been originally reported just a year ago. And so, you know, we kind of get in our little focus here, like, okay, we're doing good, we're not going to let this happen, but we'll have something that's 300-400%, I mean, I assume we live in a global environment, I always thought we did, detrimental to that, and then pay the extra cost to bring it over and use it here and think we're doing a good thing. And so, I mean, I think that's one thing we have to look at, and your point is very valid, but this is a global economy, and when we're playing by different rules, it doesn't mean we're actually helping things. And I think what the intent of this is trying to level the field a little bit and recognize that just because we don't see it happening and we just happen to have it delivered on our truck doesn't mean that it hasn't had a tremendous impact negatively in other ways. I appreciate all your comments. What we're going to do is, as I mentioned, 3604 is actually going to be the vehicle that's in the House. And this is the current amendment. I appreciate everyone's comments in terms of trying to refine this, and we'll continue to do this in this short period of time and see what we can do, and I appreciate everybody's efforts on that. Okay? So with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1050, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1026. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1026 authorizes the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to place restrictions on the license of premises for the purpose of preventing the continuation of serious and persistent alcohol sales-related problems. It does not apply to the establishments that have a history of serious and persistent problems. It does not apply to off-premises sales licensees. You have the Dash 1 amendment, which changes the phrase serious and persistent to serious or persistent throughout.
Thank you. Our sponsor of the bill is here, Senator Dinkfelder. Please come forward.
I'm afraid to make them all leave. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak today in support of Senate Bill 1026. I am Senator Jackie Dinkfelder from Senate District 23 and represent Southeast and Northeast Portland. Unfortunately, my chief co-sponsor in the House, Representative Kotek, was unable to join us today, but we do have written testimony, so we are handing out both Representative Kotek's written testimony along with mine. So why are we here today with this bill in front of you? And you'll hear from many speakers today, but this bill addresses some of the negative impacts by those few liquor license holders who do not operate their establishments in a responsible manner. Unfortunately, I have a few in my district, but this is not just a Portland issue. It's an issue statewide, and actually I'll be reading from a letter I just received from the city of Medford here in a minute. As you'll hear, this issue is of particular concern because over the past several months, myself and Representative Kotek, along with other representatives and senators that I've talked to, we've received numerous emails, letters, and phone calls from constituents who are trying to find help in dealing with problem businesses in their neighborhoods. The complaints that I have received from constituents are about a few specific liquor establishments that involve everything from excessive noise and littering to more serious problems such as drug sales and prostitution. In most instances, these complaints are about the same establishments that have been having recurring problems year after year. To address these concerns, Senate Bill 1026 provides OLCC with a much-needed tool to intervene in time to prevent these problems from spiraling out of control. This bill allows OLCC to implement a dispensing restriction, when appropriate, to help establishments comply with their liquor license agreements and be good neighbors. This change is a modest step, and not only will it benefit neighborhoods, but it also will benefit businesses by hopefully resulting in fewer fines and license cancellations. Plus, this change is badly needed because of the added burden we're placing on law enforcement personnel, and I think you'll hear from them today, at least from my fair city. With shrinking budgets for police, it makes no sense to respond again and again to the same places because of persistent problems. Instead, we need to have a better method for remedying these problems early and emphasizing to liquor license holders their obligations to their neighbors. And I just want to be clear on a couple of points. First of all, this isn't about closing businesses. This is about helping businesses be better neighbors. A licensee has several supports in place that protect their license, including, and I just want to read this to make sure I get it right, first, that proof that their problem is related to the sale of alcohol at the premise. Second, the ability to mitigate loss of their license by showing that problems are not serious or persistent, and the ability to remove restrictions by demonstrating a willingness and ability to adequately control the immediate license premise. So those are some things already in place, but and you're going to hear directly from OLCC that they certainly could use the additional tools, and that's what we're providing here. It is not requiring OLCC to implement this response. It is allowing them to utilize this tool if they need it in the few instances that you will hear about. I think you've been handed out, I'm not sure if you've received it yet, but I was emailed a letter of support from the city of Medford, and I just want to read the first paragraph because, I've heard feedback saying, well, this is just Portland. Well, unfortunately, it's not. The city of Medford sent a letter, and the city urges your support for Senate Bill 1026 with the -1 amendments. Medford continues to seek legislative support for curbing liquor establishment-related problems that cities around the state have been forced to endure. This statutory change pertaining to OLCC authority will be a step towards doing so. So I want to highlight that also there is a drafting error in the original bill, and that's what the -1 amendments fix. You'll see a few ands that have been changed to ors. That seems simple, but you'll hear how that makes a difference. So with this amendment, Senate Bill 1026 provides a needed tool that will help strengthen the safety and livability of communities throughout Oregon, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Senator. Questions for Senator Dinkfelder? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and once again, I appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill. I think you're going to hear from many other folks about why this is a much-needed tool.
Thank you. We will. Martha Pellegrino, Officer Mark Friedman, and Teresa Machetti.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino, representing the City of Portland. I want to thank the Chair and this committee for hearing this bill today, and the City is certainly supportive of it with the amendments. You'll be receiving a letter from City Commissioner Amanda Fritz, who regrets that she's unable to be here today in person, but also says thank you for this hearing. There are a couple of other letters that were sent to me, as opposed to the committee, from neighborhoods who have some interest in this bill, and so those will be distributed as well. Let me just let you know who you'll be hearing from today. We have Officer Mark Friedman from our neighborhood response team, and our liquor license program manager, Teresa Marchetti. We also have on deck, in case this committee has some legal questions, our Deputy City Attorney, Ellen Osinach, who represents the Portland Police Bureau. What I will say about the Dash 1 amendments and the drafting error, perhaps I can make that clarification. The bill is meant to reflect House Bill 3201A from the last legislative session, and essentially what it means is that when it comes to the threshold of serious and persistent, which is the threshold for license cancellation and license refusal, it lowers that threshold to serious or persistent only for the purposes of license restrictions, and I think you'll be hearing more from the agency about that, but that's essentially what it does, and I think that was the intent of this bill. So at this point, I will be available to answer questions, but I'll be turning things over to Officer Mark Friedman.
Hey, welcome, Officer.
Thank you.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you this afternoon in support of Senate Bill 1026. For the record, my name is Mark Friedman, and I'm a police officer with the Portland Police Bureau. As a neighborhood response team officer for downtown Portland, I've been working closely with licensed establishments, the OLCC, and the community for almost 12 years. The downtown Old Town Chinatown Entertainment District, where I work, has approximately 475 liquor license establishments. And I want to stress that the vast majority of these businesses operate responsibly day in and day out with few, if any, public safety or livability concerns. To the contrary, I feel that they are a vital part of the neighborhood, the economy, and the social fabric that makes Portland such a great city. Unfortunately, the Police Bureau occasionally encounters liquor license establishments that, despite our best problem-solving efforts, present serious public safety problems. In my experience, I found that it is extremely difficult to address public safety and livability problems at these establishments that are problematic through the administrative process in its current form. The threshold for serious and persistent problems has been established at a level that requires multiple serious incidents involving drunk and disorderly conduct over an extended period of time before any official action from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission can be taken. It's worth noting that many of these serious incidents involve individuals who sustain physical injuries and hospitalization as a result. So I'm here to express my support for Senate Bill 1026, which will give the Oregon Liquor Control Commission the ability to address problem liquor locations earlier through appropriate administrative sanctions. Senate Bill 1026 would allow the OLCC to place restrictions on liquor licenses at establishments that have either serious or persistent problems rather than history of serious and persistent problems. Instead of getting to the point of cancellation, problem incidents can be addressed earlier. This decreases the impact to all parties involved and increases safety to the public. Under current guidelines, the Commission has been reluctant or unable to act in some of the extreme circumstances that warrant immediate action. For example, the OLCC was unable to issue a ticket to a licensee in Portland who'd been experiencing serious public safety problems for over a year. These public safety problems included fights involving weapons and major incident which required the police to close the location for the evening and evacuate over 200 patrons from the bar. In another circumstance, 36 documented incidents involving incidents of violence and disorder at a liquor license location occurred before the commission was able to issue a notice of violation for a history of serious and persistent problems. In this particular circumstance, the commission ultimately imposed restrictions on the license at the hearing rather than order cancellation. Many of these incidents could have been avoided had the OLCC had the authority to intervene sooner. And these problem locations continue to pose major problems for the communities in which they reside with little recourse available. The Portland Police Bureau supports strategies which allows the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to intervene sooner and with greater frequency in order to resolve problems in a timely manner. It has been my personal experience that mutually beneficial results occur when public safety problems are addressed at a lower level. Persistent problems affecting livability often evolve to more serious ones, and a single violent incident such as a shooting should result in immediate action. My office is currently dealing with a liquor license location which has experienced 5 calls involving gunfire in the past year, as well as 23 incidents, documented incidents of violence and disorder. Fortunately, to date, no one has sustained a life-threatening injury as a result. As of today, the OLCC has not yet issued a ticket at this location for a history of serious and persistent problems given the guidelines they are forced to use. So again, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning. I urge you to support Senate Bill 1026, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
I think we might have a few, but let's go to the final person on this panel first.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee, for the opportunity to appear in front of you. For the record, I'm Teresa Marchetti. I'm the City of Portland's Liquor License Program Coordinator with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. I work directly with licensees in the OLCC, the community members, and the neighborhoods to problem-solve neighborhood livability issues and public safety issues at the lowest possible level. I'm here in support because this would give an opportunity to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission for them to intervene at a much lower level with a premise that is experiencing problems before the only recourse that is available is cancellation and the impacts have been rather egregious. There are establishments in which early restrictions may have prevented serious injuries. For instance, the city requested restrictions on a premise in East Portland after multiple incidents of disorderly conduct, which could not be applied under the current standards. Unfortunately, a few weeks later, those incidents escalated to a stabbing. The OLCC should have the authority to address establishments that require regular police response. Restrictions on a license can currently only be imposed if the premise would otherwise be canceled. This bill would allow the use of restrictions to address problems, which would not only decrease the negative impacts felt by communities, but would also help the licensee to regain control before they are actually facing cancellation. The small percentage of establishments that have serious or persistent problems require the assistance and oversight of the commission to regain control. By exercising greater authority at an earlier point, the commission can decrease the drain on resources for local and state. Thank you, and I am happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you. Officer Freeman, I have a question for you. Stepping away from OLCC and establishments that are serving alcohol, so another business, that let's say in the city of Portland that would have the same instances of assault, disorderly conduct, nuisance, whatever. What type of authorities, if you have these persistent problems with some other type of business, do you have or the city has to try and rectify that type of nuisance in the community?
Well, Chair Metzger, I don't know if that's a legal question. That may be our...
Probably a little bit of both. I kind of wonder about your involvement and how you address them as an officer and then maybe how the city, you know, they're licensed businesses in the city and you have those same type of neighborhood issues, but they're not an alcohol issue and something
right.
else.
For the frontline officer, our primary goal is public safety, so we respond, obviously anytime we're called to a location for an incident. As far as what happens after that, we do have some tools at our disposal at the local level to address problems which fit a very specific set of categories, and that's through our time, place, and manner ordinance. And we do use that tool to address some of these locations. However, it is just that. It is one tool that is available to us. However, it doesn't address many of the problems which this bill would be able to address through the OLCC and through the liquor license as opposed to through the hearings process at the city level. And I like I said, I don't know if maybe legal counsel might be able to shed some additional light on that. But
I would hope so because they showed up here. So I would hope that they would actually have something to say since they would. But, Yeah, please.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing the city to come here and talk about this bill. My name is Ellen Osinac, O-S-O-I-N-A-C-H, and I'm a deputy city attorney with the city of Portland. Chair Metzger, to answer your question, in a non-liquor license situation where the where a business or a residence is having particularly drug and drug-related activity, prostitution activity, if the frequency of those nuisance activities occurs in nuisance activities in a one-month period, then the city's city code allows for the city attorney to file a chronic nuisance lawsuit. So we have a civil remedy that we could pursue. It's a somewhat drastic remedy in that the statute only allows the remedy to be the closure of either the residence or the commercial establishment from 6 months to a year, and then some pretty significant financial penalties.
Well, that just seems interesting because it sounds like that's almost the same thing that the OLCC has to close the license, right? And I know the bill is aimed at trying to find some middle ground in order to change behavior as opposed to necessarily the hammer of just, closing. But it would seem that would be the same problem the city might have, and maybe looking at some of their own ordinances, what's the middle ground there? I mean, I don't know what those issues necessarily are, but just trying to look from a consistency standpoint when I'm in a neighborhood and I have a business and it may be something else and there's just a lot of stuff going on that creates issues and the police are routinely called, maybe guns are fired, from the licensing standpoint. I know Randy Leonard can't close every business in Portland, so I mean, there has to be something that, does that. So questions from the committee. Senator Berger.
I just have a problem with the bill, and I did talk with the people from the city of Portland about it, because the OLCC has a certain authority, underage, over-serving, these kinds of things. But the cities have a lot of muscle in what they can do, and they can pass ordinances that take care of it. And you're talking about not many. It's the same ones over and over, apparently, that are causing you all the trouble. And so I don't know whether the expansion of that kind of authority to the OLCC is a good idea at all. I would like to hear from the OLCC. I see them in the room, so I'd like to hear what they have to say about that kind of expansion of authority, because I think that there are other hammers that cities can have. You can have all kinds of ordinances that will take care of these, and if they really want to stay in business, then they need to clean up their act. And you're there looking at businesses that have loud noises, disturbing neighborhoods, doing those kind of things. A lot of times they've got a lot of other things that you can get them on. You can get them on drugs. You can get them on lewd behavior. You can get them on a number of other things that the OLCC would have no authority over.
And if I may, Mr. Chair and Senator Verger, I appreciate your concerns about the bill, and I think that you're absolutely right in that the cities have tools, and I think as you've heard today, our objective is not to see businesses close. We make every effort, Officer Friedman and a number of other people of the city, to work with businesses to help facilitate conversation between the community that's impacted and the businesses, and that's where we want to be. And so to the extent that sometimes the tools we have are hammers, I think we want to be very judicious in how those are used. Also, I think a point that has been made is that we want to address early. And one of the things that's difficult to do under the current statute is for there to be an early intervention tool. And other than we can be responsive, and our officers will be responsive every time they're called to an incident, because that's our responsibility. I think what we're hoping to see is an opportunity where we can be proactive so that we're not consistently responding to the same place over again. But I do appreciate your concerns, and I hope that we can work toward a solution.
follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Yes, please.
I will wait until the OLCC people come up, but I do believe that after so many times of having problems, you report it to the OLCC anyway, don't you?
Yes.
Yes, Chairman Metzger.
Yeah, officer.
Senator Berger, those police reports that are generated as a result of these types of calls
mm-hmm.
are made available to OLCC as expeditiously as possible. Many times in my office, they actually have a mailbox where we place the police reports, so they do receive that information in a timely fashion. And some of the in many of the cases I already referenced, they receive that information in a timely fashion in regards to problems that we were receiving a large volume of calls to. But under the current guidelines, OLCC is unable to administratively respond in a fashion that is at a low level. They need to essentially wait until it's reached critical mass before they're able to step in and take some sort of administrative action. And so it is one tool. Obviously, when we have instances like that, the police department, what we do is we will make every effort possible to meet with the owners of the establishment, talk about what things they're doing that they could maybe change to deal with the issues that are occurring. We try as best as we can to be proactive on the city side, to work with the owners to address the issues to the best of our ability. This bill would give the OLCC the ability to do their part help to be proactive in resolving these issues as well. So the burden isn't solely on the local jurisdiction, but also with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, who has who does serve a purpose, a fairly significant purpose, insofar as they are issuing a license to these establishments to serve alcohol, and many times alcohol being the catalyst for a lot of the bad behavior.
Well, in my hometown of Coos Bay, we have some very active bars that sometimes are a nuisance to law enforcement. So I'm going to have OLCC respond because I know that there have been remedies for those in Coos Bay, and I'm curious as to why they've remedied those and can't remedy yours. So,
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess for the city, when I was reading through the testimony from the neighborhood associations and the emails we got, it seems like a lot of the conflict comes from residential communities next door to a neighbor. I mean, these liquor facilities next to a residential neighborhood. And I remember not that many years ago, these neighborhoods came in objecting to the city's effort to create mixed-use zoning in neighborhoods. And one of their fears was that if you put mixed-use zoning into residential neighborhoods, you would create conflicts. So it seems like to me that we have kind of like all of these neighborhood associations that had concerns 6-8 years ago about mixed-use zoning coming into residential neighborhoods, kind of like their predictions have come true. And so some of this is a little bit, at least from my perspective, created by the city's policies on forcing mixed-use zoning into neighborhoods. Any kind of comment or feedback? I was noticing in the testimony they even referenced some of that stuff.
Sure. Chair Metzger, Senator George, I will say that we've brought a number of experts with us today. Our zoning expert is not one of them, but I will attempt to answer your question and invite anyone else who has some insight to do so as well. The city's ability to zone and our land use plan is one, being the city of Portland, that is encouraging density. Having said that, there are a number of liquor serving establishments that I think you might not generally think of when you think of density, grocery stores, for example. I think that in order to have a community plan where there are no liquor serving establishments near any residences at all, our borders might extend out considerably farther than they currently do, and we wouldn't have the benefit of having grocery stores in our neighborhoods. Having said that, I think we do make efforts to
given the density in Portland, be responsive to communities when there is, when say you have residences near bars and restaurants. And I would like to just emphasize again that we're talking about the vast minority of establishments where there are problems, and we have, we think density mixed-use development is a good thing, and generally we've had really good success with that. So not sure if that answers your question, but I think that our support of this legislation is because it really narrows in on where we think the problems are, as opposed to impacting all businesses, including those that operate in a responsible manner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. I got a number of people I want to hear from, and that doesn't mean you may not be asked to come back up, but that's I want to get the voices out. So we will ask Bill Perry, the Oregon Restaurant Association, Linda Ignowski, and Tom Irvin. Three of you can come up.
Mr. Chair, may I
yes.
just respond to
Please.
Senator George's
yeah.
comment?
I'll wait until he's... Senator George, I just wanted to respond to your comment about the mixed use, because in some of our neighborhoods, especially in my district, my house was built in 1924, and many of the establishments that are nearby have been there for a long time. So there is some new there are some new areas where, you know, you do have mixed use that are being built because they're new. But there's also in the city, because there's older neighborhoods where we've had, I mean, that my neighborhood is where the original Fred Meyers was, ever. The original Fred Meyers for the state. So you have, I mean, I have 82nd Avenue, which is a state highway. I think the Sandy Jug, and I'm sure Senator Metzger remembers it well. I think that's been there probably before I was born. So we have a lot of establishments that have been there a long, long time. And also because of our lack, because of our generous constitution and the lack of our ability to zone certain areas. I mean, I have several, I'll be honest with you, several adult bars very, very close to middle and high schools in my district. So I hear from those neighbors all the time about that. And I think you know that we cannot zone out those specific establishments. So again, I just want to emphasize the point is not to close down. It is to make sure that they are good neighbors, because we are all living together very closely. So I appreciate your comment, though. And for the older areas, of especially within the city, but I think there's many other cities where, you know, that's been the way it was for a long time, because that's the way we used to build, and we're sort of going back to the old pattern. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me and letting me respond to his
thank
comment.
You. Thank you. Let's get Mr. Irvin up here and Mr. Perry and Ms. Ignowski. And I think what we'll do is I'm going to start with the comments by OLCC. We'll have a kind of a broad thing, and then Mr. Perry can weigh in, having heard both the agency and the proponents. And well, again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Linda Ignowski. I'm the Regulatory Services Director for the Commission.
Good. I'm Tom Irwin, the Government Affairs Director for the agency, and appreciate the opportunity to discuss the Senate Bill 1026-1 amendments today, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 1026 would give the Oregon Liquor Control Commission an additional legal tool that we do not currently have with which to address serious problems emanating from liquor license establishments. Linda Ignowski is our Regulatory Enforcement Director. She's going to speak to the bill, and then I'll be here to answer additional questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you heard before, the majority of our licensed premises are good licensees who have no problems and follow the law. Currently, we have about almost 7,000 on-premises licenses in the state of Oregon, a total of 14,000 licenses across the state. So this is addressing, yes, a small majority, and they are problematic. Currently, I would like to give you a little history of how we deal with these problem premises. Sometimes it sounds like we don't do anything, and I just wanted to make sure that you know, wanted to know our process. When we do hear about problems coming from licensed premises, we try to do a proactive compliance building with that licensee. When we see a pattern and a history starting to develop, we bring in the licensee for an intervention meeting. We tell them this is what we're seeing, this is the problem, and what they do currently currently now is develop a voluntary compliance plan of things they will do to hopefully to relieve the problems that they're seeing in their license establishment. We give them time to implement that plan to see if it works, see if there's continuation of problems. If problems continue, then we will move towards either writing a notice of warning ticket or writing an MBT. A notice of violation for history of serious and persistent problems is cancellation. There is no other ladder to go. It's a cancellation, a proposed cancellation. This bill, what would do is probably make a compliance plan turn into restrictions. And I just want to make sure the committee knows that restrictions, yes, they are less than cancellation, but if somebody violates a restriction, it is proposed cancellation. So we put a restriction on it, and you violate it. The violation is a Category 1, which is a cancellation of your liquor license, so I wanted to make sure you knew that. I think there is a small concern about this bill, if it's just a small one, about litter, alcohol and related litter outside the premises. We haven't historically seen a lot of litter coming from on-premises, those serving by the drink inside a licensed premises. A lot of your litter usually comes from off-premises, so you may want to consider whether you want to leave that in or not. Because it's not going to be an issue with an off-premises, probably. I think this would give us probably a tool to deal with premises more immediately. What we'll have to do is go through rulemaking to determine how we would implement this to make it a fair, consistent process for licensees. It can't. Our processes try to be consistent, we try to be fair, and we try not to be arbitrary. And so trying to implement this law to determine when something is not a history, but is serious or persistent, will take some rulemaking, but all of our constituents will be invited to the table to help make rulemaking if this bill passes. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I think this bill is trying to do the right thing. It's trying to help licensees get a control of problems that are happening in the licensed premises so they will be successful as a business and be a good neighbor. And I think so the tent is a really good idea.
I think I'll go to Mr. Perry, then we'll ask questions.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, member of this committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Association, and this is obviously a bill that we've addressed in the past, and so one of the things that I told the committee, both on the House and the Senate, would I'd look into the specific example that was brought up last time. But I do want to say, you know, after the second page of my testimony, I've got an OLCC sanction schedule on there, and I do think Ms. Ignowski mentioned that this is one of 11 different Category 1s, but there's over 70 things on this list that allow you to cancel a license in different stages. This is only one of the many. And so people tend to focus on this, and I think they try to draw more into it than is intended. But I do think this list is good because there's many ways to get a liquor license. This is only one of 11 Category 1s, but up to 70s, up to Category 5s. I also included on the front page of my testimony, there's been references both last session and this session to weapons. I do not see serious and persistent as the weapon side of this. When you look at, there's a process that I've included in my testimony for immediate cancellations. When weapons are used as a threat to the public health and safety, there's a different avenue, once again, to deal with that specific issue. When we're talking about serious and persistent, it's about noise, litter, all those different things that tend not to be the egregious or serious type. That's why they're lumped in history and so from my perspective, you're talking about many different issues, but you're focusing on serious and persistent. Now, the specific example that was used during the last process was a Hawthorne Theater. A couple of ladies came in and they were disturbed by an incident that happened. So I told this committee and the House committee that I would look into it because I was not aware of the Hawthorne Theater at the time. Shortly after that, in April, we had a Office of Neighborhood Involvement, TPM. We've talked about TPM here. It's one of the local Portland areas. They have been very good about including licensees to look at different complaints and how to deal with problem establishments. Somebody from my office, Kara, usually is the one that attends these. We go to all the meetings. They've been very open, and the process, I think, has been very good from our standpoint. There were no violations that we found for the Hawthorne Theater.
no tickets, no anything that I found at this point in time, and I'm more than happy to address it. They came up for renewal in November at OLCC. The Neighborhood Association came to testify, and their testimony said there was a two-week period they did not return their phone calls in the timely fashion that they agreed to, but since that two-week period was over, they were. So I went to the hearing, but a lot of these other people did. I haven't found any violations. So once again, one of the examples used is not something that I have found had been a serious and persistent problem. On that note, when you look at the second to last page in my testimony, the hearings process that I was talking about for TPM, I've listed the sheet that we go through. The last meeting was in April of 2009. This says 2008. It was a misprint. But the second highlighted section says locations that have had violations or TPM since 1208. That was December, which was the previous meeting. And it talks about the number of complaints, and it talks about how short descriptions of where the city of Portland have found those. Then when it goes up to the top section, it says these are the ones that have been here for a while and where they're at in the process. But after they've entered the process, the resolution is at the bottom. And I just read the comments. Suspended by OLCC. No more complaints. No more complaints. Lost liquor license. Partnership agreement with new license. Successfully completed abatement period. No more complaints. And the license was evicted from the presence property. So, I mean, I guess I continue to fail to understand why the system isn't working. Now, we can argue it isn't working fast enough, but I do think there's a due process question as it relates here. Also, as brought up the city of Portland, you know, even you take the example that's been in the paper, the Greek Cuisine, which had some issues, they closed them on a fire marshal complaint. So, I mean, I get back to the problem establishments that we've been dealing with. You can talk about how quickly they get there might be a different issue, but I have not been able to find any instances where the conclusion hasn't been positive. Now, I will tell the committee, as I told last time, we are more than willing to work with different ways to deal with them, but everybody keeps focusing on serious and persistent, and it's one of the things, it deals with little stuff. It deals with too much little stuff, and it's a dangerous statute to open up when a business's livelihood is on the line. So with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions for either the agency or Mr. Perry? Yes, Senator Berger.
I have a question for the agency. An establishment in the Empire area, long history of persistent problems with it. Finally, OLCC just took the license away. Establishment closed. People are trying to sell it. They tell me that the new buyers that want to buy it are very willing to buy it, but that OLCC has said that they will not license. And whether this is true or not, I don't know. That they will not license the establishment again. It does have a long history of persistent problems. I am very sympathetic with people in neighborhoods where people are getting drunk and singing at 2 o'clock in the morning and certainly shooting weapons. On the other hand, I've seen your agency come into Coos Bay and do some very serious things to people in taking their license. So I don't understand what the problem is that you can't do it with these other situations, particularly where you say there are just a few that are giving you those problems. Why are you allowing that to persist?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, to answer your first question about the establishment that was canceled and you're hearing that we're not going to license again, that we're not supposed to. That's not true.
Okay.
A place that has been canceled, what our staff does look at to make sure that the next person who buys it can be successful. So if it's the same type of establishments, we're going to look at it very clearly to make sure that they have components in their plan, or maybe we put some restrictions on it to help it be successful the next time around. But we don't ever say we're never going to license somebody again in this location. It's kind of looking at what was the history there before, what can we do to help this licensee, the next one, coming along to be successful. And so, yes, they may have to work through a little more a compliance billing and a plan for us to be convinced that the same problems aren't going to reoccur. But we're willing to look at anybody who wants to be licensed, but we want to make sure that they're going to be successful. So that's part of what you're hearing is it's, if they're planning on doing the same type of establishment, they're going to have to work to show us that they aren't going to have the same problems. To answer your second question, it's kind of difficult. The process is maybe too slow. You know, we have case precedent. Not only do we have the law, but we have case precedent that we have to deal with. And trying to determine when is a history and when is not a history is kind of arbitrary. It really hasn't been set by rule by statute. It's kind of baked by case precedent. We've had cases where we've canceled a license on a history of serious and persistent problems on as low as 8 incidents, and then others we've had 50 to 70. Hopefully we'll never get to those again that we have 50 or 70, but sometimes the agency doesn't hear about some of the incidents until it's accumulated to 50 and then it's dumped on our desk. Portland has been very responsive, and Portland does give us this information. I think we have a pretty good working relationship with the Portland police in trying to get a handle on these places. We do have parameters in how we deal with licensed premises. A lot of the issues that neighborhood has with noise, and you'll know that you have another statute, 471329, that deals specifically with noise. And so we've kind of been using that as our guiding post for how we deal with noise in establishments. And to just refresh your memory on that statute, is that a city that has a noise ordinance, the OLCC cannot take any administrative action on that unless there's a noise ordinance violation and it's been adjudicated. So that kind of ties our hands with noise, and that's how we've dealt with noise since this statute was passed, because we can't really touch noise and do administrative sanctions on somebody until there's been adjudicated noise. We have other parameters. We have to show that there's a connection between the service of alcohol as a patron and that the licensee should be responsible for that. So you'll hear there are shots fired outside. If we can't determine that that person was a patron in the licensed premises, if we can't determine if they ever were in the premises or alcohol was connected to it, we sometimes can't take administrative action because we can't penalize the licensee when it's something they can't necessarily control.
That's right.
And so, you know, you see a lot of these incidents that say, you know, there's shots fired or these fights happening, and we have a burden of proof in this violation. We have to show there's a connection. The licensee should have taken proactive actions. They don't have a willingness or ability to control the premises. And we have been successful on history cases, but they do take time. Everybody has due process. Ability, and so making these cases and getting our act and to make sure we've got a solid case takes time. We wish we could work faster on these. We wish we had ability. And, you know, the majority of licensees that we work with who are starting to have problems, we bring them in these intervention meetings, we don't see them again. Because they got the message. They got a notice of warning. They got the message. They realized that they need to get do some proactive measures to make sure they're not in our office again, and they usually do that. We do have a handful that aren't very responsive, or it's the clientele, or it's the type of place it is, or the location. That does create a drain on local law enforcement and on us. And it does impact the neighbors, and we understand that. So within the parameters of the laws that we have, we try to do the best we can. Can we do better? Probably. But we have limited resources, too.
Mr. Chair, well, I don't think limited resources are going to change. So that's not going to expedite. And I think that's another thing that to consider. You're not going to get, you're going to continue with limited resources, but you're going to expand your authority or expand your processes. And so, I don't know. Also, the city is reporting to you, aren't they, when things are not going well, so you're well aware of those few instances where they're not going well. So the city of Portland and most cities have nuisance ordinances and noise ordinances, and do they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I don't haven't taken the tally of all of them. Most of your larger cities do.
Okay.
Any other questions for this panel? Senator Schrager.
I just have a quick question because I keep hearing, well, it's a small number and it's just the few that are causing problems for the many. What exactly, when we're talking a small number throughout the state, what's the number that you usually see that's serious and persistent if it's small? Why are we... Is this a problem? Is this such a huge problem? Because I share Senator Verger's concern that there seems to be an expansion of authority here, and there's no fiscal, so I'm assuming that somehow you're going to absorb expanded authority with no additional resources. So I wish you'd address those two pieces. Number one, how big really is the problem? And number two, how are we going to pay for it if we expand your authority?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, looking at 2008, we wrote about 12 tickets for history, serious, and persistent problems. Last year, in 2009, it looks like we wrote about 6 actual tickets. We wrote 12 warnings. And so you're looking at about 18 or more that got to the level of actual warning. I know the city of Portland says they're dealing with about 100 establishments within Portland in various stages. And so what I can give you is the facts, the figures that we actually wrote a ticket for, other ones that we wrote a warning to. So those kind of gives you a figure of what we're looking at. The fiscal impact, the reason why we didn't add a fiscal impact is because, as I said and mentioned before, we always bring these people in anyway for intervention meeting when they start looking like they have a pattern of problems. We would see this as kicking in then, and probably instead of the voluntary compliance plan is add the restrictions at that time to help them get their premises under control. And so it's the same process. It would just be adding that if they want to contest it, then they would have an ability to go to a contested case to contest those restrictions if they so choose.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I have 3 more people who want to testify, and I'm going to give them the opportunity to do that. I just would make one comment. I remember earlier this year, well, last year now, in this legislative assembly, we're working on legislation with you, for example, on the insurance bond, and that where you could suspend immediately with that insurance. And I would think if some of the instances that Officer Freeman mentioned, whatever, or similar like that, were the case, I would imagine notification of the insurance company would probably get that insurance withdrawn right away. I don't think anybody want to insure anybody like that. I'm just another tool, as Mr. Perry mentioned, that there's maybe different ways to approach that. But thank you very much for all your testimony. I have 3 other folks, Scott Winkles, Mary Ellen Glenn, and Cindy Robert wanted to comment on a previous, so Cindy can come up as well, and these will be our last 3 people.
Thank you, Chairman Metzger. Thank you, Chairman Metzger. For the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. I won't repeat some of the comments you've heard earlier, but would like to point out a couple of things, though. One, this is not exclusively a Portland issue. This is an issue for cities all around Oregon, from Fairview to Grants Pass, from Ontario to Newport. There are reports of cities are dealing with some problem establishments, not all of them, but some of them, a small minority. In point of fact, cities across Oregon right now are attempting to revitalize their downtowns and their commercial districts, and responsible OLCC license holders are a big part of those efforts. The one point I would like to make, however, is to address the issue of the local ordinance and why that is not a complete tool, and there are a couple reasons for that. One, the local ordinance on noise is not getting it. You're not getting at the root of the problem. The root of the problem is overservice and alcohol management issues. Noise is a symptom of that, and the local nuisance ordinances, due to some preemptions on how the preemptions from cities regulating liquor establishments, we just can't get it. It was really causing the problem, so that's one issue. And the other issue is that sometimes overservice isn't necessarily going to show up in a neighborhood complaint. So, for instance, if you have an establishment in a smaller community that's overserving, and you're not getting noise complaints, the overservice may be showing up in your number of DUI arrests. that's not, you can't get at the establishment in that situation. Typically, when during a DUI interview, the officer is going to ask the person where they were drinking. When you start seeing the pattern develop, you can see a persistent problem. It may not be serious, but it certainly is persistent. And that's the major issue. And to articulate the cost to the city of an establishment that's over-serving and we're seeing people on the roads, one DUI arrest can take 8 hours of a police officer's time in processing the arrest, investigating the arrest, sitting on the tow, administrative hearings at DMV, court cases, the court case. Most of that's going to be on overtime. That's a significant cost to the city. One serious injury wreck or a fatality accident, not only has a life been taken and a family been shattered, but that's 40 hours of a police officer's time in both the investigation and court process. So it's a significant issue to the cities of Oregon. With that, I'm eager for your questions.
Thank you. Chair Metzger, member of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. My name is Mary Ellen Glenn, and I actually work for the State Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. However, I'm here as a private citizen on behalf of a neighborhood watch group. I've testified on this bill before, or on a similar bill last year. Our neighborhood association abuts a commercial district with a lot of bars and restaurants, and one club in particular, which was referenced earlier, is a significant problem in our area. It is an all-ages music club, and we've had repeated problems with them. And it is a lot of the nuisance problems you'd expect. Music that is loud, people returning to their cars late, throwing up on our lawns, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not actually why we're here, why we got galvanized. We got galvanized because the club started catering to a neo-Nazi skinhead crowd with these neo-Nazi skinhead bands. As you can imagine, this brings a certain amount of violence along with it. Patrons would go into this club, some of them underage, get drunk, start fights, get kicked out, and come into our streets and continue to fight, essentially. As you can imagine, the neighborhood got pretty upset with this, and we decided we needed to take some action. We tried repeatedly to talk to the owner of the club. I'm sorry, Mr. Perry is erroneous in what he said earlier about this particular club. There are no time, place, and manner violations. However, we have talked to him many times. There are many OLCC violations for over-service and underage drinking. I'm happy to provide you with the details on this. With the help of the City of Portland, after we got absolutely no response from the owner of this club, we took the issue to the OLCC, hoping to see if they could help us. Mainly because if you put the squeeze on this person where the money is on their liquor license, maybe they'll respond. And it's funny, but it turned out that there was nothing that the OLCC could do short of canceling their license, as you've heard earlier today. Now, we're not interested in putting this club out of business. We like our neighborhood. We like the fact that there's music in our neighborhood. Some of our neighbors actually go to this club. But we needed them to address the problem of this violence and the type of patron they were attracting. But because there's no interim enforcement measures for the OLCC, there was very little that they could do. Because we kind of were really organized and made a big stink about it and were frankly really obnoxious about it all last year and got some publicity about it, we were able to bring the owner of the club to the table to talk to us. And last summer, we actually had a very nice, quiet summer. They stopped having some of the violent incidents in the street, and it was great. But I begin to wonder what happens in neighborhoods where people aren't obnoxious and aren't organized. They don't have the tools they need to try and shut down some of these businesses, or at least give them OLCC the tools they need. So I'm asking you to pass this bill out of committee. I think it's something that the state could use. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Klein. Ms. Robert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the city of Medford. You already have my testimony, and since this hearing's long enough to start making Senator George drink, I think that I will just answer one question that kept coming up about what local governments can do to solve this problem. City of Medford does not feel they can do much to solve the problem of chronic bars that are having difficulties. People have said, can't you revoke their business license? In Medford, if the city discovers a business is engaged in unlawful activity, we can revoke their business license. But this is activity that's going on in or around and not necessarily with the knowledge of the business owner, and we couldn't prove that anyway. So we cannot take away their business license. Our chronic nuisance ordinance makes it so we can't do it if the owner of the restaurant or bar calls in one of the nuisance claims then in the city of Medford, then we can't go and pull that person's license or write them up for a chronic problem because they actually self-reported something that was going on in their area. Our concern here is that serious and persistent together make this a black and white issue. It doesn't have to be black. It doesn't have to be white. It doesn't have to be an open bar versus a closed bar. We're talking about a middle ground and not an expansion of authority, but an expansion of assistance. And one more thing that my city and some of the other cities outside of the Portland area where there may actually be more activity, but some of the other cities can point to the OLCC and say, I have a serious problem. I have a problem that's not very serious, but it's certainly persistent. And can you help us give that bar owner, that restaurant owner, some tools and some parameters that will help them be a better restaurant?
Questions? You know,
I guess I'm a little bit confused because over-serving and underage drinking is absolutely under the purview of the OLCC. So they can certainly do an awful lot about that. And they have stings. They're testing whether some poor grocery clerk has sold to an underage kid. So it seems to me are a sting on the on their own stores. If this is the kind of thing, why aren't they doing stings on that? I'm just confused by it. I don't understand why.
Ms. Signowski, would you be the one for this? The question. I'd like to have Senator Verger have a chance to have a response from the OLCC on it.
I don't know why you're not using the tools
the
you have.
If you give us a succinct answer on that, that would be really helpful.
Yeah, because I'm sympathetic with these people that have the problem. But what I can't figure out is why you're not the solution.
Mr. Chair, Senator Virgil, we try to be the solution when we can. And
what does that mean?
Well,
typically, to Senator Berger's questions about underage drinking stings, I mean, in
we
terms
do those,
of what
yes.
you're, what you're, and what action you can take if you find that problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, for underage drinking, we do decoy operations. People are fined. The person who sells and also the licensee is held responsible for that. If they sell four times within 2 years, they could lose their license. Three times is a cancellation. If they do it twice in 2 years, that's a $5,000 fine or a 30-day suspension. So there's a severe consequence for this. And the same thing with selling to visibly intoxicated persons. However, you know, it is harder to make those cases, but when we do make them at the same level, that if they're caught, they get fined or suspended, or the fourth time in 2 years is cancellation. So we try very hard. Those are our priorities, and we try very hard to deal with those.
To follow up on Senator Verger's question, you talk about the suspension for the underage drinking, whatever. So let's say you had a sting with an establishment or whatever, and you found that information. You verify the underage drinking. How fast would it take from that moment on for you to suspend them pending further action?
Mr. Chair, first violation, first time you go in, it's a fine of $16.50 or a 10-day suspension. They can take their choice. If we go again a second time within 2 years, it's $5,000 or a 30-day suspension. If they sell three times within a two-year period, it's 30-day suspension mandatory. If they sell four times within 2 years, it's a cancellation.
But I guess my question was, and I guess I didn't...
Oh, how fast?
I didn't phrase it right. If you get that, I have the evidence, how long from that day and that you can enforce a suspension?
Mr. Chair, so I misunderstood your question. We have a new process. We have had a process for a long time called, we call it expedited process. Within as little as 10 days, you could, 5 days, you would get a notification you're getting a violation, and we could issue it's kind of like a ticket, you get a traffic ticket. A person could choose to pay it then or not. They have 15 days to make a decision or not, or go to a hearing. So most of them have no aggravation. Those can be done fairly quickly.
Well, we heard testimony that they had no option except to cancel their license, and that's not so. There is a process, intermittent process. Also, the bartender, you might want to address that, the person that's doing the over-serving.
Mr. Chair, yes, they also get a bartender would get administrative sanction on their service permit, and the licensee would get a violation ticket. I think what you heard from my clarification, I think, is that cancellation for a history of serious and persistent problems, the only remedy is a cancellation, proposed cancellation. And that's what this was kind of about.
Okay. Other questions? Thank
well,
you.
I'm just going to reiterate that I'm very sympathetic with the people bringing the problems. Mm-hmm. I just can't quite figure out why we're not doing a little bit more about it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Committee, just a couple of things on this. I think Mr. Perry had a very valid point addressing to what you just said, Senator Berger, and that is, because we've had this issue a number of times, so this is not new to the committee, and that is focusing on this one category, one issue. And that's, you know, and so if you take a narrow focus that this is the only way we can do it and therefore we want to have a mitigating opportunity, it does seem like there's no tools. But as Mr. Perry pointed out, and the OSCC also said, there are other ways to do that, to get to something short of just ending the license, but use a different tool rather than simply using a blinder and focusing on this one category. And what I would like to do is ask that, you know, Mr. Perry and the OSCC, the City of Portland, other advocates for this, to rather than, you know, continue to bring it back and we kind of try to determine what facts are versus what other tools are, is that maybe there is another category or a refined rather than going to rule, but actually working on a specific, how to address a specific problem that somehow seems to be in between everything else from the opponent side and the proponent side. And there may be another way rather than trying to use the same thing and then arguing whether that is effective or not, if there is a new element that could be developed that might specifically address issues and provide certainty and to both business owners and neighborhoods that's outside of the scope of how we presently have it. And I would ask that between now and the next regular session that we sit down together cooperatively and say, okay, tell me specifically what is the issue, give me the examples, and see if there's a way that you may be able to come to consensus on a different way to address a specific type of action. I think that would probably be the most fruitful. Could help the neighborhoods, the OLCC, the cities, as well as the business owners. But it's very hard to get your arms around something that still seems kind of generic, and that there's other things that are flying out there that could be applied. But maybe there's a way to consolidate those into a particular policy that we could put into law that could affect some of that. So I would ask you to do that in the interim, and I would say for the proponents, you know, to take the initiative on that. I'm sure Mr. Perry and others would be helpful and willing to sit down with the department and, you know, let's look at some real examples and see if we can find another way to address that and bring that back in 2011. Okay? Thank you very much for the testimony. Thank you, committee, for holding over to make sure everybody got heard. And we are adjourned.